Hello to everybody. Good afternoon. I want to introduce our speaker today, who is Kezia Samuel. She's the Director of Client Portfolio Management at AssetMark, and she's responsible for writing commentary on market performance and current events. She's also responsible for communicating the investment process, like today, positioning and performance on the guided portfolios. She's got over 19 years of experience, including working as a derivatives trader and senior portfolio manager. So I am thrilled that we have Kezia with us today, and I will let her take it from here.
Sounds good. Thank you, Sharla. Thank you, Jeff. And thank you to all of those that have joined in this late afternoon conversation, and certainly what has been a historic few weeks. I want to start off by saying that there is a significant health crisis going on, and I certainly want to be respectful of the human cost, because today we'll focus our discussion on the financial markets and the economy, and I certainly don't mean to sound callous nor minimize the impact that it's had on any given individual. Our discussion today will focus on what's taken place in the market so far, then we'll pivot into what will it take to generate a sustainable rally. We'll talk about how the GPS, or the Guided Portfolio Solutions, which is part of many of your portfolios, how have they adapted in this environment? And then finally, some long-term perspective as investors, is there any consolation in what we have seen relative to history for all of us to look for? Let's start with what we know. The stock markets entered bear market territory, ending the longest bull market in just days after its 11th anniversary. So we enjoyed 11 years of a strong bull run. Days after that, we ended into bear market territory. This bear market is the definition of a 20% drop from record highs, which was seen just on February 19th, just a few weeks ago. We saw the market high, we dropped 20%, and that 20% drop happened in a mere 16 days. Stocks then continued to fall. In fact, the worst that we saw from the top to the trough, as we call it, was down 35%. We have since recovered from there, but that drop to 35% happened in less than a month. Just for some perspective, in 2008 and 2009, we did see the markets drop 35% as well. But it took the markets a full year to do so back in 2008, that which happened in less than a month here in March of 2020. This drop of 35%, again, we have seen significant rally since then, is important because that's right in line with long-term averages during bear markets. But the speed of the decline was simply breathtaking. What's less known, perhaps, is what's unfolded in bond markets outside of U.S. government bonds, such as treasuries. The rest of the bond market also got jittery during the panic we saw unfold in the stock market. We saw high-quality corporate government bonds. These are household names that we're all familiar with. Also started to see their bonds or their debt sell off sharply. One of the reasons why we saw the Fed step in so aggressively in March to ensure the crisis in the bond market did not become a financial one. This is not a financial crisis like back in 2008, but it could have unfolded to become one, which is why the Fed stepped in aggressively. And since then, the bond markets have normalized and stabilized and recovered significantly after the Fed's action. And I share this as just the background of the volatility was not just seen in the stock markets, which happened on an extremely short time frame, but also in the bond side of the market, giving our portfolio managers certainly a challenge to navigate in markets like this. So how do we look forward? What's ahead of us? What will it take for the markets to develop a sustained rally? And I'm going to use the analogy of a three-legged stool, and each of the legs to the stool is going to give us some insight that the markets will require in order to feel comfortable to move forward. The first is the successful containment of the virus, specifically in developed markets. And to that effect, the rally that we saw in the markets over the last 2 days has been over the fact that Spain, Italy, and even New York City have seen their cases peak. We've also heard this conversation of flattening. Flattening does not mean no new cases, but rather a slowing rate at which the number of cases occurs. This week certainly has provided us some green shoots of hope, but it's too early to say definitively, without any therapeutics or vaccine, that this is a sustainable trend. The markets will continue to watch, is this virus contained, as that first leg that we need to have more clarity around. The second is, what is the economic impact of this virus? How will the U.S. economy, how will companies react as it relates to the social distancing experiment we're all facing? And to that date, again, we only have 38 days since this all has unfolded. But we did get some data points, and let's start with the data that we do know, which is we got two big unemployment claims, which was 3.3 million and 6.6 million, a total of 9.9. To place that in context, the previous highest number of unemployment claims we saw was for 695,000 back in 1982. So these are big numbers. But it's important to understand, don't just look at the headline numbers. The contribution to unemployment in the last two prints that I shared came primarily from retail, restaurants, and leisure industry. These sectors account for 20% of the U.S. labor force, roughly 35 million individuals or so. However, it's important to understand its impact as well. These sectors combine as a total together contribute 12% to our economic output, meaning in the GDP numbers that we see, these sectors contribute around 12% to the growth that we see in our economy on an annual basis. Whereas in 2008, the number of jobs lost were smaller, but the sectors impacted were financial, banks, insurance companies, and construction, the housing industry. In comparison, those two sectors, financials and construction, which were at the epicenter of the 2008 financial crisis, accounted for 25% of our economic output. So even though we lost fewer jobs in 2008, its economic impact was much more significant than the sectors that are currently impacted. And one of the big reasons for that is that the many of the workers in the retail, the restaurant, the travel and the leisure industry are often part-time workers and often lower wage workers. The point that I'm trying to share here is that you're likely to see big negative headlines come through. It's important to look past those numbers and understand what is the true economic impact, and they're not all one and the same. The CARES Act that has been passed will likely provide some ailment to the pain we're all feeling. And the example that I use of the economy today is that it is suspended in animation. For any of you with children or grandchildren that have likely watched the movie Frozen 1,000 times, whether you wanted it or not, that's where the state of the economy is. We are just frozen in suspended animation at the moment. What the impact of this down the road from retail to other sectors will be is still being determined. So we don't have the data to that front. Meanwhile, we're seeing jobs being added on other fronts, whether it's remote conferencing, like the call we're on today, whether it's Amazon looking to add 100,000 jobs. We're likely to see the job markets innovate to adapt to the current market conditions, but nonetheless, we are likely to feel some pain, and we need more data in order to understand the second leg to the stool, which is also an ongoing development. The third leg to the stool is what we have received some information on, and that's the global policy response based on what the Federal Reserve and other central banks, as well as what the fiscal stimulus, which Congress passed recently. Let's start with both of these. On the Federal Reserve side, monetary policy has been swift and decisive. The Fed has spent $454 billion and has committed what we saw the Fed do in 2008. Clearly, the Fed is not messing around this time. After learning lessons from the Great Financial Crisis, that is to go big and go bold or just go home. I think they've got this for the go big and go bold. On the stimulus side from the fiscal, which is the Congress and the CARES Act that was passed, that's $2.3 trillion in the CARES Act. That is three times the size of the stimulus bill passed in the wake of the Great Financial Crisis. So you can hear, if I'm not able to echo it clearly, these numbers are large and significant. But the best analogy to describe why we have seen take this action, both from the monetary as well as the fiscal side, is like the economy caught the flu. And what we have been given as a result of these stimulus bills is like taking NyQuil. It's not going to cure the flu, but it will make you feel a lot better in being able to handle the flu. Without the NyQuil, so to speak, in the stimulus, the pain that we would have felt would have been significantly worse than perhaps what the patient could handle, and maybe it would have led to pneumonia instead. Just to give you an analogy of what we have seen, there's a variety of things in the stimulus bill. On a high level, we have seen individuals with $75,000 or income and less receive paychecks of $1,200, an additional $500 per child. Unemployment has been increased. The average unemployment is $380. We've added another $600 on top of that for an extended 4 to 6 month time period. Extended how long you can claim unemployment for. Plus, on the small business side, the current stimulus is for $360 billion in forgivable loans. In short, I mean, these are big numbers. If you're asking, you're wondering, is there any firepower left after what we have seen the Fed and the U.S. government spend? And the answer, in short, is they're willing to throw the kitchen sink at this, just like all of the central banks and governments that have forced businesses to shut down as a result of the environment we're in. So the third leg to this stool is a positive one, one that has provided some calm in the market over the last few weeks as these news unfolded. But the first two legs to this stool are ongoing developments. And until we find a better clarity on those two, market volatility is likely to remain as we find progress on the other two fronts. With that said, in light of this environment, I want to now pivot into how we have adjusted the portfolios that we manage on your behalf. I want to start by stating that the comments I'm about to make are much more general in nature as it relates to our flagship portfolios for growth. If you have specific questions on your individual accounts, certainly that's something that you can discuss with Sharla on a one-on-one basis. But in the portfolios that we construct, they're meant to be broadly diversified portfolios, and I'm going to try and use an analogy to sort of walk us through how we build this portfolio. In this diversified portfolio, I'm going to try and build a car at the same time, so let's see if it makes sense in all of this. We start with traditional diversification, that is across stocks and bonds, not just here in the U.S., but we go globally as well, and build what we call the core component. This is the engine of your car, and this is going to give you the gas power to continue on. And that's where we build the heart of your portfolio, stocks and bonds. We build the traditional diversified allocation, but we don't stop there. We then take it a step further by adding tactical managers that can pivot in this marketplace, whether they want to be 100% invested in the stock market or pull back risk entirely. And the closest analogy to use here is like, this is the steering wheel of your car. It allows us to help turn down winding roads. So we're going to add this tactical manager or tactical components into portfolio in addition to the engine that we built to begin with. Finally, we're going to blend in diversifying strategies. And the analogy that I use is this is a seatbelt, right? If you're making sharp turns on the road going with the engine, just the gas pedal so far, you need a seatbelt to make sure that you don't get thrown off the road. And these managers have the ability in their toolkit to not just buy, but also sell depending on the market conditions. It helps them navigate the markets a bit more better than what we can in traditional markets. So what we have seen the portfolios do using the different components is that our core markets have stayed invested as we expected, but the investments that they made in high quality U.S. government bonds like treasuries have helped expose the portfolio's downside and minimize those. They've served as the equity diversifiers well in that category. Our tactical managers have, as a result of volatility going up, pulled us out of the stock market and into cash and bonds as appropriate. And they will continue to do so as market volatility persists and or elevates potentially. Finally, our diversifying managers have been able to take advantage of this market. It's hard to state that, isn't it? In today's markets, we expect most investments, most opportunities are showing negative returns. Instead, our diversifying investments, our managers there, have been able to take advantage by selling the oil market, taking advantage of going and investing specifically in certain areas of the bond market, and have posted positive returns when that is a hard statement to make in the broad stock and bond market. So they certainly have helped by adding a different element into this portfolio. So you say, okay, so we built the chassis of the car, we've got the engine, we've got the steering wheel, we've got the seat belt. What about brakes? Don't you have any brakes in this portfolio? And what we have done in the analogy that I'm going to continue using is we also, in addition to allowing the money managers to make the decisions and investments, we in addition have tactical indicators that are going to allow us to reduce how much we have invested in risky portions of the marketplace. And we have two proprietary indicators that have allowed us to, again, de-risk the portfolios systematically during the month of March as this market elevated in volatility. So in summary, right, in terms of high level changes in the portfolios, what we have seen, this has been the fastest bear market in history. We saw the decline in 35% happen in less than a month. We saw bond markets outside of treasuries also get hit, especially during that first quarter. As a result, the GPS portfolios, or the guided portfolio solutions, I'm going to call it GPS in short, which started the year by being fully invested in the market, started to systematically de-risk, and as a result of de-risking that portfolio, plus the diversification that's been built in through the variety of money managers that we use, has helped us protect the downside. So instead of seeing the entire equity market fall, a broadly diversified client that's been in a moderate portfolio, so instead of a 60-40 portfolio, in comparison to the stock market as a 100% portfolio, has been taking less than half of the downside risk, so to speak. So just to give some high-level considerations on how the portfolios have been navigating the markets that we have seen, which has happened in a very, very short span of time, very difficult for money managers to make pivots and shifts. Nonetheless, the portfolios have been able to de-risk and protect for the downside should volatility continue. I'm going to end with this. When we look at the question that I often get is, why do we still have any stocks in the portfolio? Shouldn't we just wait for markets to clear? Here are two reasons why we still have stocks in the portfolio. The first being, as investors, we're often focused on the downside. We think of the losses we have seen, but we don't think of the returns on the upside. We lost 3.5 years of gains in less than a month, and that's painful. There is no doubt in however we look at that. However, if we were to look at what would it take to return back to the highs of February 19th, if we were to do so in 3 years, that would translate to the stock market generating a return of 17% per year during those 3 years. If it would take the market 5 years, let's say you're skeptical that this may be the worst thing we have seen and it may take us 5 years, if that's the case, then it would take the market, the stock market, an 11% annualized rate of return in order to break even to the February 19th high that we saw. So on the upside, as we come out of these markets, it's important to look at those markets and see that the growth on the other side can be significant. And as a result, we certainly don't want to be left trying to time the market, which is where I will focus on the second concept. Trying to time the market by going all out of investments and into cash and waiting for the coast to clear is an extremely challenging prospect. Here is what our research has shown us. We took $10,000 put it into the S&P 500 from a period of January 1st of 94 through December of 2019, and that $10,000 portfolio grew to $112,000. We then looked to see the impact of that portfolio by missing just 10, 20, and 30 of the best days in the marketplace during that entire 26-year time span. Here's what we found. Simply missing the 10 best days drops that return by 50%. So instead of $112,000 that you would have gained by simply remaining invested, the portfolio's returns have been cut in half to $56,000. And here's why this happens over and over again. While the worst performing days absolutely happen during bear markets, so do many of the best performing days. Trying to time the market and without missing the top 10 days requires surgical precision. So instead, we like to include tactical money managers who can pivot and reduce the risk and find a defined strategy to enter the market and not solely based on all of our emotions. So hopefully what I was able to share, I completely acknowledge that it's easier said than done to remain calm in markets like this when all of our life savings are on the line, including my own. But we firmly believe like this crisis, like all others, we will come out to the other side. Markets have always recovered. But the one thing that we all require in order to navigate this, is that weathering short-term volatility is absolutely critical to accomplishing our long-term goals. And the way to do this within our portfolios is by navigating systematically and removing the emotions out of the equation to a point where you can tolerate and de-risk the portfolio without having to make fundamental shifts of all out or all in. I'm going to pause there, Charlotte, and see if I made sense, if I need to clarify anything, or we can dive into the Q&A section.
No, I think that was great, Casey. I really appreciate your comments and thoughtful feedback. We did get a number of questions. I want to thank all of you for those, and I've combined them into three questions that we have time for. Starting off with a client asked, I'm concerned about all the relief packages, $3+ trillion, and how we will pay for them in the future. Historically, when the government does something like that, does it mean bad things for the market?
That's a great question. And for let's start with, there's three pieces to that. The first is, yes, this $2.3 trillion stimulus that's been added is going to add to our existing deficit of already $1 trillion. So we'll take our deficit to $3 trillion today. If there's more stimulus, it's likely that number gets bigger. Our debt to GDP is going to, today, based on the numbers that we know so far, is at 15% of this fiscal year and likely to be 25% next year. And again, if we pass more stimulus bills, that percentage that I shared of debt to GDP is just going to go up. But sadly, the first thing I want to start with is this is a much needed remedy. And the analogy I'm going to use here is a cardiac patient. So let's say we're all doctors, we're playing doctors here for a moment. There's a cardiac patient on the operating table in front of us, and you're deciding whether you want to use the paddle or not to resuscitate the client. Not really a choice, is it? And when the economy was essentially forced to shut down as the way it was, the choice of whether or not it would require us to spend this, it is not much of a choice. But having said that, it's likely that inflation, which is the key concern down the road, a word that we really have not seen very much of in the last 10 years, is going to be a concern in the intermediate to long term. Inflation comes when there is more demand than supply. Let's look at the scenario we're about to play out in the next few months. Central banks all around the globe are cutting rates and buying bonds. Basically, they're pumping money into the system. The fiscal authorities, as a result, are going to have to issue more debt. There is no other way to support this. We're not going to have enough revenues to support this. So if they all continue to issue debt all at the same time, and the only large buyer are central banks, as a result of all this tsunami of debt coming our way, this will likely create problems as it relates to inflation down the road, because at some point, there's not going to be enough goods for all the money that the federal and central banks are spending on. But having said that, just as no one expected financial markets and the economy to turn as quickly as it did over the last few weeks, I don't think we can expect inflation to rise quickly either. But it is a intermediate term thing that we should all consider within portfolios, and are we prepared adequately for that? So that's how I think of what is the implication for this. It's not necessarily bad for the market. It was absolutely needed for the market. But in terms of our portfolios and its implications, the bigger question is, how will this impact inflation, and will our portfolios be appropriately adjusting to address that? Long-winded answer, Charlotte, but hopefully I connected a few of the thoughts in there.
Yes, thank you. Next question. I've heard we are now more likely to have a U-shaped recovery versus a V-shaped recovery. Could you compare and contrast those for us, Kezia?
It's forward-looking in anticipation of what the economy is. Let me elaborate for a brief moment here. Historically, when the market declines 30% or more, it already prices in a recession. Now, officially, we've not even had one negative quarter. A recession is defined as two consecutive quarters, so 6 months in total of negative growth. That is a technical definition of a recession. The economy, which is measured by GDP, is backward looking. So it'll take some time for us to get that statistic and to be publicly known. As investors, we're likely to see a whole bunch of bad news in between, but that doesn't mean that the stock market doesn't already know that information. The stock market, which is forward looking, is likely to turn well before the economy turns south, which is what we saw, right? Stock market's already fell 30%, pricing in that recession. Similarly, it's going to start turning back up well before the downturn ends. And here's the very interesting but strong point that I want to leave us with. When you look at markets from 1930 onwards, and we looked at the stock markets during the years when GDP or our growth was negative, there have been 18 years with negative GDP growth since 1930. In 12 of those 18 years, the stock market returns were positive, and in most cases, well over 18%. Why is that? Because the stock market is going to start to move up and down well before the economy pivots. And this is exactly what we saw during the Great Financial Crisis. The stock market peaked in October of 2007, and it began to decline well before the recession. It was 14 months before the recession was officially announced. Stock markets had already fallen well in advance of that. Similarly, on the way out, markets bottomed. But in March of 2009, it bottomed right in the 16 months before the recession end was officially announced. So instead of focusing on, are we going to get a U-shaped recovery or is it a V-shaped recovery, don't focus on the economy, because the markets have priced in a lot of the data and in advance makes those anticipatory moves for us. That's a better reaction to look for as it relates to all of our portfolios. Helpful, Charlotte, in terms of shedding color on that one?
Yes, thank you, thank you. Next and last question. I've always lived by the saying, be a long-term investor, but we have some lower risk holdings too for shorter term needs. How are those lower risk holdings types of investments being managed in the current market?
So anything, when I say long-term, it's important to understand the definition. The average bear market lasts 14 months in what we have seen, and then the recovery can be an additional time frame for there. So anyone with under 3 years cannot likely take equity market risk or the stock market risk. And anything underneath there depends. The question is fairly wide open. So I want to make sure from a cash perspective, money market funds have been stable, right? This issue of whether 2008-like scenario has replayed itself, and that is not the case, which is why precisely the Fed took aggressive action. So if you're in the money market spectrum, and or short-term CDs and or banks, they're much better stabilized as a result of the 2008 regulations that were passed. Their balance sheets are healthier. So that end of the spectrum, if you were ultra short and high quality, was relatively unscathed in this marketplace. But if you stepped out into a traditional bond market looking for yield, whether it was by buying corporate debt and or high yield, meaning lower quality or junk bonds, those investments certainly did take a hit. It matters where you were on the bond end of the spectrum. Money markets, CDs, banks are steady and strong. You stepped out further to seek yield into the corporate bonds or high yield. That's where we have seen some of the turbulence play out. So for short-term investors, the experience has been varied depending on which end of the spectrum they have been, so to speak.
Great, thank you. Thank you very much, Kezia. I think that's it for us today, and thank you to all of the clients who joined us.
Thank you, Charlotte.